The bunched white knots of Belch's knuckles glimmered through the decaying flesh of his fingers. The Fury began to move down Kansas Street toward Upmile Hill. "How you doing, Belch?" Henry heard himself say. It was stupid, of course. Belch couldn't be here. Dead people couldn't drive cars. But it was all he could think of. Belch didn't reply. His one sunken eye stared at the road. His teeth glared sickly at Henry through the hole in his cheek. Henry became vaguely aware that old Belch smelled pretty ripe. Old Belch smelled, in fact, like a bushel basket of tomatoes that had gone bad and watery. The glove compartment flopped open, banging Henry's knees. And in the light of the small bulb inside, he saw a bottle of Texas Driver half full. He took it out, opened it, and had himself a good shot. It went down like cool silk and hit his stomach like an explosion of lava. He shuddered all over, moaning, and then began to feel a little better, a little more connected to the world. "Thanks," he said. Belch's head turned toward him. Henry could hear the tendons in Belch's neck. The sound was like the scream of rusty screen door hinges. Belch regarded him for a moment with a dead, one-eyed stare, and Henry realized for the first time that most of Belch's nose was gone. It looked like something had been at the old Belcher's nose. Dog, maybe. Or maybe rats. Rats seemed more likely. The tunnels they had chased the little kids into that day had been full of rats. Moving just as slowly, Belch's head turned toward the road again. Henry was glad. Old Belch staring at him that way. Well, Henry hadn't been able to dig it too much. There had been something in Belch's single sunken eye. Reproach? Anger? What? "There is a dead boy behind the wheel of this car." Henry looked down at his arm and saw that huge goose bumps had formed there. He quickly had another snort from the bottle. This one hit a little easier and spread its warmth farther. The Plymouth rolled down Upmile Hill and made its way around the counterclockwise traffic circle. Except at this time of night, there was no traffic. All the traffic lights had changed to yellow blinkers splashing the empty streets and closed buildings with steady pulses of light. It was so quiet that Henry could hear the relays clicking inside each light. Or was that his imagination? "Never meant to leave you behind that day, Belcher," Henry said. "I mean, if that was, you know, on your mind." The scream of dried tendons again. Belch looking at him again with his one sunken eye, and his lips stretched in a terrible grin that revealed gray-black gums which were growing their own garden of mold. "What sort of a grin is that?" Henry asked himself as the car purred sulkily up Main Street, past Freese's on the one side, Nan's Luncheonette, and the Aladdin Theater on the other. Is it a forgiving grin? An old pal's grin? Or is it the kind of grin that says, "I'm going to get you, Henry. I'm going to get you for running out on me and Vic"? What kind of grin? "You have to understand how it was," Henry said, and then stopped. How had it been? It was all confused in his mind, the pieces jumbled up like the pieces of a jigsaw puzzle that had just been dumped out on one of the shitty card tables in the rec room at Juniper Hill. How had it been, exactly? They had followed the fat boy and the bitch back to Kansas Street and had waited back in the bushes, watching them climb up the embankment to the top. If they had disappeared from view, he and Victor and Belch would have dropped the stalking game and simply gone after them. Two of them were better than none at all, and the rest would be along in time. But they hadn't disappeared. They had simply leaned against the fence, talking and watching the street. Every now and then they would check down the slope into the barrens, but Henry kept his two troops well out of sight. The sky, Henry remembered, had become overcast, clouds moving in from the east, the air thickening. There would be rain that afternoon. What had happened next? What? A bony, leathery hand closed over his forearm and Henry screamed. He had been drifting away again into that cottony grayness, but Belch's dreadful touch and the dagger of pain in his stomach from the scream brought him back. He looked around, and Belch's face was less than 2 inches from Henry's. He gasped in breath and wished he hadn't. The old Belcher really had gone to seed. Henry was again reminded of tomatoes going quietly putrescent in some shadowy shed corner. His stomach roiled. He remembered the end suddenly, the end for Belch and Vic, anyway. How something had come out of the darkness as they stood in a shaft with a sewer grating at the top, wondering which way to go next. Something. Henry hadn't been able to tell what, until Victor shrieked, "Frankenstein! It's Frankenstein!" And so it was. It was the Frankenstein monster, with bolts coming out of its neck and a deep-stitched scar across its forehead, lurching along in shoes like a child's blocks. "Frankenstein!" Vic had screamed. "Frank!" And then Vic's head was gone. Vic's head was flying across the shaftway to strike the stonework of the far side with a sour, sticky thud. The monster's watery yellow eyes had fallen on Henry, and Henry had frozen. His bladder let go, and he felt warmth flood down his legs. The creature lurched toward him, and Belch... Belchhead... "Listen, I know I ran," Henry said. "I shouldn't have done that, but... but..." Belch only stared. "I got lost," Henry whispered, as if to tell the old Belcher that he had paid, too. It sounded weak, like saying, "Yeah, I know you got killed, Belch, but I got one fuck of a splinter under my thumbnail." But it had been bad, really bad. He had wandered around in a world of stinking darkness for hours, and finally, he remembered, he had started to scream. At some point he had fallen, a long, dizzying fall, in which he had time to think, "Oh, good, in a minute I'll be dead. I'll be out of this." And then he had been in fast-running water, under the canal, he supposed. He had come out into fading sunlight, had flailed his way toward the bank, and had finally climbed out of the Kanduskeag less than 50 yards from the place where Adrian Mellon would drown 26 years later. He slipped, fell, bashed his head, blacked out. When he woke up, it was after dark. He had somehow found his way out to Route 2 and had hooked a ride to the home place. And there the cops had been waiting for him. But that was then and this was now. Belch had stepped in front of Frankenstein's monster, and it had peeled the left side of his face down to the skull. So much Henry had seen before fleeing. But now Belch was back. And Belch was pointing at something. Henry saw that they had pulled up in front of the Derry townhouse. And suddenly he understood perfectly. The townhouse was the only real hotel left in Derry. Back in 58, there had also been the Eastern Star at the end of Exchange Street and the Traveler's Rest on Tyrault Street. Both had disappeared during urban renewal. Henry knew all about this. He had read the Derry News faithfully every day in Juniper Hill. Only the townhouse was left and a bunch of ticky-tacky little motels out by the interstate. "That's where they'll be," he thought, "right in there. All of them that are left, asleep in their beds with visions of sugar plums, or sewers, maybe, dancing in their heads. And I'll get them. One by one, I'll get them." He took the bottle of Texas Driver out again and bit off a snort. He could feel fresh blood trickling into his lap, and the seat was tacky beneath him, but the wine made it better. The wine seemed to make it not matter. He could have done with some good bourbon, but the driver was better than nothing. "Look," he said to Belch. "I'm sorry I ran. I don't know why I ran. Please, don't be mad." Belch spoke for the first and only time, but the voice wasn't his voice. The voice that came from Belch's rotting mouth was deep and powerful, terrifying. Henry whimpered at the sound of it. It was the voice from the moon, the voice of the clown, the voice he had heard in his dreams of drains and sewers where water rushed on and on. "Just shut up and get them," the voice said. "Sure," Henry whined. "Sure, okay, I want to, no problem." He put the bottle back in the glove compartment. Its neck chattered briefly like teeth. And he saw a paper where the bottle had been. He took it out and unfolded it, leaving bloody fingerprints on the corners. Embossed across the top was this logo in bright scarlet. A memo from Pennywise. Below this, carefully printed in capital letters: Bill Denbro, 311. Ben Hanscom, 404. Eddie Kasbrack, 609. Beverly Marsh, 518. Richie Tozier, 217. Their room numbers. That was good. That saved time. Thanks, Beth. But Belch was gone. The driver's seat was empty. There was only the New York Yankees baseball cap lying there, mold-crusted on its bill, and some slimy stuff on the knob of the gear shift. Henry stared, his heart beating painfully in his throat, and then he seemed to hear something move and shift in the back seat. He got out quickly, opening the door and almost falling to the pavement in his haste. He gave the Fury, which still burbled softly through its dual cherry bomb mufflers, Cherry bombs had been outlawed in the state of Maine in 1962. A wide berth. It was hard to walk. Each step pulled and tore at his belly. But he gained the sidewalk and stood there, looking at the 8-floor brick building which, along with the library and the Aladdin Theater and the seminary, was one of the few he remembered clearly from the old days. Most of the lights on the upper floors were out now, but the frosted glass globes which flanked the main doorway blazed softly in the darkness, haloed with moisture from the lingering ground fog. Henry made his laborious way toward and between them, shouldering open one of the doors. The lobby was wee hours silent. There was a faded Turkish rug on the floor. The ceiling was a huge mural executed in rectangular panels which showed scenes from Derry's logging days. There were overstuffed sofas and wing chairs and a great fireplace which was now dead and silent, a birch log thrown across the andirons. A real log, no gas. The fireplace in the townhouse was not just a piece of lobby stage dressing. Plants spilled out of low pots. The glass double doors leading to the bar and the restaurant were closed. From some inner office, Henry could hear the gabble of a TV turned low. He lurched across the lobby, his pants and shirt streaked with blood. Blood was grimed into the folds of his hands. It ran down his cheeks and slashed his forehead like war paint. His eyes bulged from their sockets. Anyone in the lobby who had seen him would have run screaming in terror. But there was no one. The elevator doors opened as soon as he pushed the up button. He looked at the paper in his hand, then at the floor buttons. After a moment of deliberation, he pushed 6 and the doors closed. There was a faint hum of machinery as the elevator began to rise. Might as well start at the top and work my way down. He slumped against the rear wall of the car, eyes half closed. The hum of the elevator was soothing, like the hum of the machinery in the pumping stations of the drainage system. That day, it kept coming back to him, how everything seemed almost prearranged, as if all of them were just playing parts. How Vic and the old Belcher had seemed, well, almost drugged. He remembered. The car came to a stop, jolting him and sending another wave of griping pain into his stomach. The doors slid open. Henry stepped out into the silent hallway. More plants here, hanging ones, spider plants. He didn't want to touch any of them, not those oozy green runners. They reminded him too much of the things that had been hanging down there in the dark. He rechecked the paper. Kasprak was in 609. Henry started down that way, running one hand along the wall for support, leaving a faint bloody track on the wallpaper as he went. Ah, but he stepped away whenever he came close to one of the hanging spider plants. He wanted no truck with those. His breathing was harsh and dry. Here it was. Henry pulled the switchblade from his pocket, swashed his dry lips with his tongue, and knocked on the door. Nothing. He knocked again, louder this time.
Who's it?
Sleepy, good. He'd be in his jammies, only half awake. And when he opened the door, Henry would drive the switchblade directly into the hollow at the base of his neck, the vulnerable hollow just below the Adam's apple.
Bellboy, sir, Henry said. Message from your wife.
Did Kasprak have a wife? Maybe that had been a stupid thing to say. He waited, coldly alert. He heard footsteps, the shuffle of slippers.
From Myra?
He sounded alarmed. Good. He would be more alarmed in a few seconds. A pulse beat steadily in Henry's right temple.
I guess so, sir. There's no name. It just says your wife.
There was a pause, then a metallic rattle as Kasprak fumbled with the chain. Grinning, Henry pushed the button on the switchblade's handle. Click. He held the blade up by his cheek, ready. He heard the thumb bolt turn. In just a moment, he would plunge the blade into the skinny little creep's throat. He waited. The door opened, and Eddie... 10. The losers all together. 1:20 p.m. Saw Stan and Richie just coming out of the Costello Avenue market, each of them eating a rocket on a push-up stick.
Hey, he shouted. Hey, wait up.
They turned around and Stan waved. Eddie ran to join them as quickly as he could, which was not, in truth, very quickly. One arm was immured in a plaster of Paris cast, and he had his Parcheesi board under the other.
What you say, Eddie? What you say, boy?
Richie asked in his grandly rolling southern gentleman voice, the one that sounded more like Foghorn Leghorn in the Warner Brothers cartoons than anything else.
I say, the boy's got a broken arm. Look at that, Stan. The boy's got a broken arm. I say, be a good sport and carry the boy's parcheesi board for him.
I can carry it, Eddie said, a little out of breath. How about a lick on your rocket?
Your mom wouldn't approve, Eddie, Richie said sadly. He began to eat faster. He had just gotten to the chocolate stuff in the middle, his favorite part.
Germs, boy. I say, you can get germs eaten after someone else.
I'll chance it, Eddie said. Reluctantly, Richie held his rocket up to Eddie's mouth and snatched it away quickly as soon as Eddie had gotten in a couple of moderately serious licks.
You can have the rest of mine if you want, Stan said. I'm still full from lunch.
Jews don't eat much, Richie instructed. It's part of their religion.
The three of them were walking along companionably enough now, headed up toward Kansas Street and the Barrens. Derry seemed lost in a deep, hazy afternoon doze. The blinds of most of the houses they passed were pulled down. Toys stood abandoned on lawns, as if their owners had been hastily called in from play or put down for naps. Thunder rumbled thickly in the west.
Is it? Eddie asked Stan.
No, Richie's just pulling your leg, Stan said. Jews eat as much as normal people.
He pointed at Richie, like him.
You know, you're pretty fucking mean to Stan, Eddie told Richie. How would you like somebody to say all that made-up shit about you just because you're a Catholic?
Oh, Catholics do plenty, Richie said. My dad told me once that Hitler was a Catholic, and Hitler killed billions of Jews. Right, Stan?
Yeah, I guess so, Stan said. He looked embarrassed.
My mom was furious when my dad told me that, Richie went on. A little reminiscent grin had surfaced on his face. Absolutely furious. Us Catholics also had the Inquisition. That was the little dealie with the rack and the thumbscrews and all that stuff. I figure all religions are pretty weird.
Me too, Stan said quietly. We're not Orthodox or anything like that. I mean, we eat ham and bacon. I hardly even know what being a Jew is. I was born in Derry, and sometimes we go up to synagogue in Bangor for stuff like Yom Kippur, but... He shrugged.
Ham? Bacon? Eddie was mystified.
He and his mom were Methodists.
Orthodox Jews don't eat stuff like that, Stan said. It says something in the Torah about not eating anything that creeps through the mud or walks on the bottom of the ocean. I don't know exactly how it goes, but pigs are supposed to be out, also lobster. But my folks eat them. I do too.
That's weird, Eddie said and burst out laughing. I never heard of a religion that told you what you could eat. Next thing, they'll be telling you what kind of gas you can buy.
Kosher gas, Stan said and laughed by himself. Neither Richie nor Eddie understood what he was laughing about.
You gotta admit, Stanny, it is pretty weird, Richie said. I mean, not being able to eat a sausage just because you happen to be Jewish.
Yeah? Stan said.
You eat meat on Fridays?
Geez, no, Richie said, shocked. You can't eat meat on Friday because...
He began to grin a little.
Oh, okay, I see what you mean.
Do Catholics really go to hell if they eat meat on Fridays?
Eddie asked, fascinated, totally unaware that until two generations before, his own people had been devout Polish Catholics who would no more have eaten meat on Friday than they would have gone outside with no clothes on.
Well, I'll tell you what, Eddie, Richie said. I don't really think God would send me down to the hot place just for forgetting and having a bologna sandwich for lunch on a Friday. But why take a chance, right?
I guess not, Eddie said. But it seems so stupid, he was going to say. And then he remembered a story Mrs. Portlay had told the Sunday school class when he was just a little kid, a first grader in Little Worshippers. According to Mrs. Portlay, a bad boy had once stolen some of the communion bread when the tray was passed and put it in his pocket. He took it home and threw it into the toilet bowl just to see what would happen. At once, or so Mrs. Portlay reported to her rapt little worshippers, the water in the toilet bowl had turned a bright red. It was the blood of Christ, she said, and it had appeared to that little boy because he had done a very bad act called a blasphemy. It had appeared to warn him that, by throwing the flesh of Jesus into the toilet, he had put his immortal soul in danger of hell. Up until then, Eddie had rather enjoyed the act of communion, which he had only been allowed to take since the previous year. The Methodists used Welch's grape juice instead of wine, and the body of Christ was represented by cut-up cubes of fresh, springy Wonder Bread. He liked the idea of taking in food and drink as a religious rite. But following Mrs. Portlay's story, his awe of the ritual darkened into something more potent, something rather dreadful. Simply reaching for the cubes of bread became an act which required courage, and he always feared an electrical shock, or worse, that the bread would suddenly change color in his hand, become a blood clot, and a disembodied voice would begin to thunder in the church. Not worthy, not worthy, damned to hell, damned to hell. Often after he had taken communion, his throat would close up, his breath would begin to wheeze in and out, and he would wait with panicky impatience for the benediction to be over, so he could hurry into the vestibule and use his aspirator. "You don't want to be so silly," he told himself as he grew older. "That was nothing but a story, and Mrs. Portlay sure wasn't any saint. Mama said she was divorced down in Kittery, and that she plays bingo at St. Mary's in Bangor, and that real Christians don't gamble. Real Christians leave gambling for pagans and Catholics." All that made perfect sense, but it didn't relieve his mind. The story of the communion bread that turned the water in the toilet bowl to blood worried at him, gnawed at him, even caused him to lose sleep. It came to him one night that the way to get this behind him once and for all would be to take a piece of the bread himself, toss it in the toilet, and see what happened. But such an experiment was far beyond his courage. His rational mind could not stand against that sinister image of the blood spreading its cloud of accusation and potential damnation in the water. It could not stand against that talismanic magical incantation. "This is my body. Take, eat. This is my blood, shed for you and for many." No, he had never made the experiment. "I guess all religions are weird," Eddie said now. "But powerful," his mind added, "almost magical." Or was that blasphemy? He began to think about the thing they had seen on Niebold Street, and for the first time he saw a crazy parallel. The werewolf had, after all, come out of the toilet. "Boy, I guess everybody's asleep," Richie said, tossing his empty rocket tube nonchalantly into the gutter. "You ever see it so quiet? What, did everybody go to Bar Harbor for the day?" "Hey, you guys," Bill Denbro shouted from behind them. "Well, hate up." Eddie turned, delighted as always to hear Big Bill's voice. He was wheeling Silver around the corner of Costello Avenue, outdistancing Mike, although Mike Schwinn was almost brand new. "Hey-oh, Silver, away!" Bill yelled. He rolled up to them, doing perhaps 20 miles an hour, the playing cards clothespinned to the fender struts roaring. Then he backpedaled, locked the brakes, and produced an admirably long skid mark. "Stuttering Bill," Richie said. "How are you, boy?" "I say, how are you, boy?" I'm okay, Bill said. "Seen Ben or Heverly?" Mike rode up and joined them. Sweat stood out on his face in little drops. "How fast does that bike go, anyway?" Bill laughed. I don't know exactly. Pretty fast. "I haven't seen them," Richie said. "They're probably down there, hanging out, singing two-part harmony. Shaboom, shaboom, yada-da-da-da-da-da. You look like a dream, sweetheart." Stan Uris made throwing up noises. "He's just jealous," Richie said to Mike. "Jews can't sing." "Ba-ba-ba." "Beep, beep, Richie," Richie said for him, and they all laughed. They started toward the Barrens again, Mike and Bill pushing their bikes. Conversation was brisk at first, but then it lagged. Looking at Bill, Eddie saw an uneasy look on his face, and he thought that maybe the quiet was getting to him, too. He knew Richie had meant it as a joke, but it really did seem that everyone in Derry had gone to Bar Harbor for the day. To somewhere. Not a car moved on the street. There wasn't a single old lady pushing a carrier full of groceries back to her house or apartment. "Sure is quiet, isn't it?" Eddie ventured, but Bill only nodded. They crossed to the barren side of Kansas Street, and then they saw Ben and Beverly running toward them, shouting. Eddie was shocked by Beverly's appearance. She was usually so neat and clean, her hair always washed and tied back in a ponytail. Now she was streaked with what looked like every kind of gluck in the universe. Her eyes were wide and wild. There was a scratch on one cheek, her jeans were caked with crap, and her blouse was torn. Ben fell behind her, puffing, his stomach wobbling. "Can't go down in the Barrens," Beverly was panting. "The boys, Henry, Victor... they're down there somewhere. The knife. He has a knife." Slow down, Bill said, taking charge at once in that effortless, almost unconscious way of his. He glanced at Ben as he ran up, his cheeks flushed bright, his considerable chest heaving.
"She says Henry's gone crazy, Big Bill,"
Ben said. Shit, you mean he used to be sane? Richie asked and spat between his teeth. Shut up, Richie, Bill said, and then looked back at Beverly. To tell, he said. Eddie's hand crept into his pocket and touched his aspirator. He didn't know what all this was, but he already knew it wasn't good. Forcing herself to speak as calmly as possible, Beverly managed to get out an edited version of the story, a version that began with Henry, Victor, and Belch catching up to her on the street. She didn't tell them about her father. She was desperately ashamed of that. When she was finished, Bill stood silent for a moment, hands in his pockets, chin down, Silver's handlebars leaning against his chest. The others waited, throwing frequent glances at the railing that ran along the edge of the drop-off. Bill thought for a long time, and no one interrupted him. Eddie became aware, suddenly and effortlessly, that this might be the final act. That was how the day's silence felt, wasn't it? The feeling that the whole town had up and left, leaving only the deserted husks of buildings behind? Richie was thinking about the picture in George's album that had suddenly come to life. Beverly was thinking about her father, how pale his eyes had been. Mike was thinking about the bird. Ben was thinking about the mummy and a smell like dead cinnamon. Stan Urus was thinking of blue jeans, black and dripping, and hands as white as wrinkled paper, also dripping. Come on, Bill said at last. Well, we're going to the down. Bill, Ben said. His face was troubled. Beverly said Henry was really crazy, that he meant to kill. It's not theirs, Bill said, gesturing at the green dagger-shaped slash of the barrens to their right and below them. The underbrush, the choked groves of trees, the bamboo, the glint of water. It's not their property. He looked around at them, his face grim. I'm tired of being harried by them. We beat them in the rock fight, and if we have to beat them again, we'll do it. But Bill, Eddie said, what if it's not just them? Bill turned to Eddie, and with real shock, Eddie saw how tired and drawn Bill's face was. There was something frightening about that face, but it wasn't until much, much later, as an adult drifting toward sleep after the meeting at the library, that he understood what that frightening thing was. It was the face of a boy driven close to the brink of madness, a boy who was perhaps ultimately no more sane or in control of his own decisions than Henry was. Yet the essential Bill was still there, looking out of those haunted, scarified eyes. An angry, determined Bill. Well, he said, what if it's not? No one answered him. Thunder boomed, closer now. Eddie looked at the sky and saw the storm clouds moving in from the west in black thunderheads. It was going to rain a bitch, as his mother sometimes said. Now, how I'll tell you what, Bill said, looking at them. None of you have to go with me if you don't want to. That's up to you. I'll go along, Big Bill, Richie said quietly. Me too, Ben said. Sure, Mike said with a shrug. Beverly and Stan agreed, and Eddie last. I don't think so, Eddie, Richie said. Your arm's not, looking too cool. Eddie looked at Bill. I will want him, Bill said. You will walk with me, Eddie. I'll keep an eye on you. Thanks, Bill, Eddie said. Bill's tired, half-crazy face seemed suddenly lovely to him, lovely and well-loved. He felt a dim sense of amazement. I'd die for him, I guess, if he told me to. What kind of power is that? If it makes you look like Bill looks now, it's maybe not such a good power to have. Yeah, Bill's got the ultimate weapon, Richie said. B.O. bombs. He raised his left arm and fluttered his right hand under the exposed armpit. Ben and Mike laughed a little, and Eddie smiled. Thunder boomed again, close and loud enough this time to make them jump and huddle closer together. The wind was picking up, rattling trash around in the gutter. The first of the dark clouds sailed over the hazy, ringed disk of the sun, and their shadows melted away. The wind was cold, chilling the sweat on Eddie's uncovered arm. He shivered. Bill looked at Stan and said a peculiar thing then. You've got your bird book, Stan? Stan tapped his hip pocket. Bill looked at them again. Let's go down, he said. They went down the embankment single file, except for Bill, who stayed with Eddie as he had promised. He allowed Richie to push Silver down, and when they had reached the bottom, Bill put his bike in its accustomed place under the bridge. Then they stood together, looking around. The coming storm did not produce a darkness, not even precisely a dimness. But the quality of the light had changed, and things stood out in a kind of dreamlike, steely relief. Shadowless, clear, chiseled. Eddie felt a sinking of horror and apprehension in his guts as he realized why the quality of this light seemed so familiar. It was the same sort of light he remembered from the house at 29 Niebolt Street. A streak of lightning tattooed the clouds, bright enough to make him wince. He put a hand up to his face and found himself counting. 1, 2, 3. And then the thunder came in a single coughing bark, an explosive sound, a sound like an M-80 firecracker, and they drew even closer together. "Wasn't any rain forecast this morning," Ben said uneasily. "The paper said hot and hazy." Mike was scanning the sky. The clouds up there were black-bottomed keelboats, high and heavy, swiftly overrunning the blue haze that had covered the sky from horizon to horizon when he and Bill came out of the Denbro house after lunch. "It's coming fast," he said. "Never saw a storm come so fast." And as if in confirmation, thunder whacked again. "Come on," Bill said. "Well, let's put Eddie's Parchee Heasy board in the clubhouse. They started along the path they had beaten in the weeks since the incident of the dam. Bill and Eddie were at the head of the line, their shoulders brushing the broad green leaves of the shrubs, the others behind them. The wind gusted again, making the leaves on the trees and bushes whisper together. Farther ahead, the bamboo rattled eerily, like drums in a jungle tale. "Bill?" Eddie said in a low voice.
"What?"
"I thought this was just in the movies, but..." Eddie laughed a little. "I feel like somebody's watching me."
"Oh, they're all right," Bill said.
Eddie looked around nervously and held his Parcheesi board a little tighter. 11. Eddie's room, 3.05 a.m. Opened the door on a monster from a horror comic. A gore-streaked apparition stood there, and it could only be Henry Bowers. Henry looked like a corpse which has returned from the grave. Henry's face was a frozen witch doctor's mask of hate and murder. His right hand was cocked at cheek level, and even as Eddie's eyes widened and he began to draw in his first shocked breath, the hand pistoned forward, the switchblade glittering like silk. With no thought, there was no time. If he had stopped to think, he would have died. Eddie slammed the door closed. It struck Henry's forearm, deflecting the knife's course so that it swung in a savage side-to-side arc less than an inch from Eddie's neck. There was a crunch as the door pinched Henry's arm against the jamb. Henry uttered a muffled cry. His hand opened. The knife clattered to the floor. Eddie kicked it. It skittered under the TV. Henry threw his weight against the door. He outweighed Eddie by over 100 pounds, and Eddie was driven back like a doll. His knees struck the bed, and he fell on it. Henry came into the room and swept the door shut behind him. He twisted the thumb bolt as Eddie sat up, wide-eyed, his throat already starting to whistle.
"Okay, fag," Henry said.
His eyes dropped momentarily to the floor, hunting for the knife. He didn't see it. Eddie groped on the night table and found one of the two bottles of Perrier water he had ordered earlier that day. This was the full one. He had drunk the other before going to the library because his nerves were shot and he had a bad case of acid burn. Perrier was very good for the digestion. As Henry dismissed the knife and started toward him, Eddie gripped the green pear-shaped bottle by the neck and smashed it on the edge of the night table. Perrier foamed and fizzed across it, flooding out most of the pill bottles that stood there. Henry's shirt and pants were heavy with blood, both fresh and semi-dried. His right hand now hung at a strange angle.
"Baby fag," Henry said, "teach you to throw rocks."
He made it to the bed and reached for Eddie, who still hardly realized what was happening. No more than 40 seconds had elapsed since he had opened the door. Henry grabbed for him. Eddie thrust the ragged base of the Perrier bottle at him. It ripped into Henry's face, pulling open his right cheek in a twisted flap and puncturing Henry's right eye. Henry uttered a breathless scream and staggered backward. His slit eye, leaking whitish-yellow fluid, hung loosely from its socket. His cheek sprayed blood in a gaudy fountain. Eddie's own cry was louder. He got off the bed and went toward Henry. To help him, perhaps, he wasn't really sure. And Henry lurched at him again.
Eddie thrust with the Perrier bottle as if with a fencing sword, and this time the jagged points of green glass punched deep into Henry's left hand and sawed at his fingers.
Fresh blood flowed. Henry made a thick, grunting noise, the sound almost of a man clearing his throat, and shoved Eddie with his right hand. Eddie flew back and struck the writing desk. His left arm twisted behind him somehow, and he fell on it heavily. The pain was a sudden, sickening flare. He felt the bone go along the fault line of that old break, and he had to clench his teeth against a scream of agony. A shadow blotted out the light. Henry Bowers was standing over him, swaying back and forth. His knees buckled, his left hand was dripping blood on the front of Eddie's robe. Eddie had held onto the stump of the Perrier bottle, and now, as Henry's knees came completely unhinged, he got it in front of him, jagged base pointing upward, the cap braced against his sternum. Henry came down like a tree, impaling himself on the bottle. Eddie felt it shatter in his hand, and a fresh bolt of grinding agony shuddered through his left arm, which was still trapped under his body. Fresh warmth cascaded over him. He wasn't sure if this batch was Henry's blood or his. Henry twitched like a landed trout. His shoes rattled an almost syncopated beat on the carpet. Eddie could smell his rotten breath. Then Henry stiffened and rolled over. The bottle protruded grotesquely from his midsection, capped end pointing toward the ceiling as if it had grown there.
"Gug,"
Henry said, and said no more. He looked up at the ceiling. Eddie thought he might be dead. Eddie fought off the waves of faintness that wanted to cover him over and drag him down. He got to his knees and finally to his feet. There was fresh pain as his broken arm swung out in front of him, and that cleared his head a little. Wheezing, fighting for breath, he made it to the night table. He picked his aspirator out of a puddle of carbonated water, stuck it in his mouth, and triggered it off. He shuddered at the taste, then gave himself another blast. He looked around at the body on the carpet. Could that be Henry? Could it possibly be? It was. Grown old, his crew cut more gray than black, his body now fat and white and slug-like, it was still Henry. And Henry was dead. At long last, Henry was...
"Gug,"
Henry said, and sat up. His hands clawed at the air, as if for holes which only Henry could see. His gouged eye leaked and dribbled, its bottom arc now bulged pregnantly down onto his cheek. He looked around, saw Eddie shrinking back against the wall, and tried to get up. He opened his mouth and a stream of blood gushed out. Henry collapsed again. Heart racing, Eddie fumbled for the telephone and succeeded only in knocking it off the table and onto the bed. He snatched it up and dialed O. The phone rang again and again and again. "Come on," Eddie thought. "What are you doing down there, jacking off? Come on, please answer the frigging phone." It rang again and again. Eddie kept his eyes on Henry, expecting him to start trying to gain his feet again at any moment. Blood. Dear God, so much blood. "Desk," a fuzzy, resentful voice said at last. "Ring Mr. Denbrough's room," Eddie said, "quick as you can." With his other ear, he was now listening to the rooms around him. How loud had they been? Was someone going to pound on the door and ask if everything was all right in there? "You sure you want me to ring?" the clerk asked. "It's 3:10. "Yes, do it," Eddie nearly screamed. The hand holding the phone was trembling in convulsive little bursts. There was a nest of waspy, rotten, ugly singing in his other arm. Had Henry moved again? No, surely not. "Okay, okay," the clerk said. "Cool your jets, my friend." There was a click, and then the hoarse burr of a room phone ringing. "Come on, Bill, come on." A sudden thought, gruesomely plausible, occurred to him. Suppose Henry had visited Bill's room first, or Richie's, Ben's, Bev's. Or had Henry perhaps paid a visit to the library? Surely he had been somewhere else first. If someone hadn't softened Henry up, it would have been Eddie lying dead on the floor, with a switchblade growing out of his chest the way the neck of the Perrier bottle was growing out of Henry's gut. Or suppose Henry had visited all the others first, catching them bleary and half asleep, as Henry had caught him. Suppose they were all dead. And that thought was so awful, Eddie believed he would soon begin screaming if someone didn't answer the phone in Bill's room. "Please, Big Bill," Eddie whispered. "Please be there, man." The phone was picked up, and Bill's voice, uncharacteristically cautious, said, "Hello?"
"Bill,"
Eddie said, almost babbled. "Bill, thank God."
"Eddie?"
Bill's voice grew momentarily fainter, speaking to someone else, telling the someone who it was.
Then he was back strong. Well, what's the matter, Eddie?
It's Henry Bowers, Eddie said.
He looked at the body on the floor again.
Had it changed position?
This time it was not so easy to persuade himself it hadn't.
Bill, he came here, and I killed him. He had a knife.
He lowered his voice.
I think it was the same knife he had that day, when we went into the sewers. Do you remember?
I remember, Bill said grimly. Eddie, listen to me. I want you to... 12. The Barons, 1:55 p.m.
Go back and tell Ben to come up here.
Okay, Eddie said, and dropped back at once. They were approaching the clearing now. Thunder rumbled in the overcast sky, and the bushes sighed in the rising breeze. Ben joined him as they came into the clearing. The trap door to the clubhouse stood open, an improbable square of blackness in the green. The sound of the river was very clear, and Bill was suddenly struck by a crazy certainty that he was experiencing that sound and this place for the last time in his childhood. He drew a deep breath, smelling earth and air and the distant sooty dump, fuming like a sullen volcano that cannot quite make up its mind to erupt. He saw a flock of birds fly off the railroad trestle and toward the old cape. He looked up at the boiling clouds.
What is it?
Ben asked.
Why haven't they tried to get us?
Bill asked.
They're there. Eddie was right about that. I can heal them.
Yeah, Ben said.
I guess they might be stupid enough to think we're going back into the clubhouse. Then they'd have us trapped.
Maybe, Bill said. And then he felt a sudden helpless fury at his stutter, which made it impossible for him to talk fast. Perhaps they were things he would have found impossible to say anyway. How he felt he could almost see through Henry Bowers' eyes. How he felt that, although on opposite sides, pawns controlled by opposing forces, he and Henry had grown very close. Henry expected them to stand and fight. It expected them to stand and fight and be killed. A chilly explosion of white light seemed to fill his head. They would be victims of the killer that had been stalking Derry ever since George's death. All seven of them. Perhaps their bodies would be found, perhaps not. It all depended on whether or not it could or would protect Henry, and to a lesser degree, Belch and Victor.
Yes, to the outside, to the rest of this town, will have been victims of the killer. And that's right. In a funny sort of way, that really is right. It wants us dead. Henry's the tool to get it done, so it doesn't have to come out. Me first, I think. Beverly and Richie might be able to hold the others, or Mike. But Stan's scared, and so is Ben, although I think he's stronger than Stan. And Eddie's got a broken arm. Why did I lead them down here? Christ, why did I?
Bill, Ben said anxiously. The others joined them beside the clubhouse. Thunder whacked again, and the bushes began to rustle more urgently. The bamboo rattled on in the fading, stormy light.
Bill.
It was Richie now.
Shh.
The others fell uneasily silent under his blazing, haunted eyes. End of side 25. To continue, turn the cassette over.